But something awakened in him after reading that book. And the baptized imagination, I would say, theologically, is the regenerative or the regenerated imagination.
Welcome to All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast. I'm your host, William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm very pleased to say that Dr. Jerry Root is my guest today. He is a highly respected C.S. Lewis scholar and a much in-demand speaker. In fact, I caught up with him to make the following recording just before the 2015 C.S. Lewis and Inkling Society Conference in Grove City, Pennsylvania. Jerry is the author or co-author of a number of books, and he was the consulting editor for the C.S. Lewis Bible. The primary focus of my chat with him is about a forthcoming book due out this September entitled The Surprising Imagination of C.S. Lewis. But I did have Jerry share a few things about himself because this is my first interview with him. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Thank you, William. It's a privilege to be with you.
Well, now, the key purpose of having you here today is to talk about a forthcoming book at the time of this recording. It's possible if people are obviously listening to it later that it is already out. The title I have is The Surprising Imagination of C.S. Lewis. And then the subtitle is listed presently as an introduction. Let me go ahead, Jerry, though. People should probably be familiar with various titles that you've had out. One of the most well-knowns that I would think would be is The Quotable Lewis. And then more recently, titles like The Soul of C.S. Lewis. But again, we're talking about a forthcoming book, The Surprising Imagination of C.S. Lewis. But first, go ahead and give some background about what you presently do and how you got into C.S. Lewis.
Presently, I teach at Wheaton College, which is a small liberal arts college in the western suburbs of Chicago. And I teach in Christian formation and ministry, and I'm also working in the evangelism initiative at the Billy Graham Center at Wheaton College. Wheaton is the school that Graham graduated from, but it's also the school that houses the largest collection of C.S. Lewis materials in the world. As a matter of fact, there are several authors related to Lewis who are housed in that collection. G.K. Chesterton, George MacDonald, Dorothy Sayers, Owen Barfield, Charles Williams, C.S. Lewis, and who did I leave out? Anyway, there are seven authors. So these authors, they have amassed these massive collections, original manuscripts, stuff that is unpublished, and if anybody wants to study any of these authors, it's the place to go. Bodleian Library in Oxford has many of these things as well. And so on both sides of the Atlantic, it's easy for people who have limited resources to go and study at one of these centers. So I teach. I've been teaching C.S. Lewis courses for the last 35 years. I've lectured on Lewis, I think, in 62 universities and 12 or 13 different countries. I can't even remember now. And so I've just been enjoying this life. I've been studying him for 45 years, Lewis's writings. And I did my master's thesis on Lewis. I was in seminary at the time, and I knew I had to write a master's thesis, but I wasn't going to be able to write it on the use of the optative mood in the Greek text of Philemon. It just wasn't going to hold me, but I figured Lewis might. And then later did my doctoral dissertation on C.S. Lewis, and my first supervisor was Basil Mitchell, who had been the vice president of the Socratic Club at Oxford, and later when Lewis went to Cambridge, he became the president of the Socratic Club. Lyle Dorsett was also a supervisor. Steve Beebe and Jeff Davis walked me through the last edition. They're both rhetoricians.
Well then now, what was the first book that you read by Lewis?
I have to first say I grew up in South Central Los Angeles. I had no real academic interests. You have to take it by faith now, but I was an athlete back then, and I desperately wanted to play sports. So I went to college for that purpose. I had just barely the grades to get in. And right at the beginning of my time in college, I became a Christian. And I started reading. That's when I became a reader. That was the changing point for me. Read through the Bible from cover to cover that first year. Started sharing my faith. People asked me questions. I had no clue what the answers were. I never even had asked up to that time. about the problem of evil. It hadn't even crossed my mind. I've since done a book on that. But at that time, I didn't know any of this stuff. And it was while telling people how they were loved by God and forgiven that the questions that came back were the things that caused me to search. And I saw Lewis's name come up in the research, naturally. But my older sister was teaching fifth grade, and she found this book that she really liked that she was reading to her kids called The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And over dinner one night, she told me the plot of the book, and I said, come on, there's books like that? So I went out and bought the whole set and read through them and liked them very much, but that's not the book that hooked me, even though they were the first. I wanted to find out about Lewis. So I went and read his autobiography, Surprised by Joy. And in this book, he talks about these deep longings that he had, almost haunted by them, and his quest to find the object of those longings. I knew the longings, William. I knew them existentially, firsthand. And Lewis was the first person to ever give me a vocabulary for my own soul. Now, I not only read Lewis, and I've read everything many, many times, but I also like to read the books he refers to. And I see many people who have written about these longings. I mean, it's such a common mention of these things throughout the great works of our tradition and our civilization that you realize that they probably are common. And I don't want to say universal because I'd have to ask everybody, and I haven't done that kind of study. But nevertheless, it was this concept that really hooked me into Lewis. So I started reading him as voraciously as I could. And when I graduated from college, a person wisely said to me, you did not get an education in college. All you did was lay a foundation for an education. And commencement, the graduation ceremonies, as they're called, means that you're going to commence your education by building on that foundation. Pick an author who will take you places and make that author your life study. I think he could have said, pick a composer, an artist, a period of history, a country, but something that will keep you engaged and it will lead you to other studies and you will stay curious all your life. And Lewis was the author I picked, and I doubt I could have done better.
Well, now again, one of the key purposes is your forthcoming book, The Surprising Imagination of C.S. Lewis. I understand that this is something that you worked with another author. What's some background about how this idea came to be to write about this topic?
Well, first off, in 45 years of reading Lewis, I found out not only is he a man of great imagination, Austin Farah, a fellow Inkling philosopher at Oxford University, said Lewis, though he was very logical and reasonable, his greatest gift was in depiction. His ability to create imaginatively images, metaphors, similes, analogies that would help his readers grasp some difficult concept. So he could give the skeletal structure propositionally and then flesh it out with some sort of imaginative depiction. Even Evelyn Underhill, when she wrote to him, he said, "The greatest literary experience of my life was in receiving a letter from you." And she said, "The great thing about you is that you are able to give imaginative embodiment to complex theological issues." So as I would read Lewis, I started seeing that he would say different descriptive terms about kinds of imagination. And over the years, I've collected about 32 of these. Now, they say the Eskimos have 30 different words for snow because they live in the snow. And they see nuances that people who don't know the snow like they do. And the interesting thing, I tried to do some research and I found out there's about 9 Eskimo words for snow. But they add prefixes and suffixes onto those same 9 words and it comes to about 28 different words. So too Lewis, as he comes up with these different words for the imagination, shows us a man who trafficked in the world of the imagination. Matter of fact, he even says in one of his letters, "The imaginative man in me is older than the rational man and more continuously operative." So therefore, I felt like understanding these particular words would be a great thing to set forth for people who want to do more serious Lewis study and whatnot. There's a group that meets at my house every Thursday evening. and we meet from about 9 to midnight. We call ourselves the Brotherhood of the Briar. We break out our pipes. We always begin with a Robert Service poem. I have some friends, some honest friends, and honest friends are few. A pipe of briar, an open fire, and a book that's not too new. And then somebody, while the single malt scotch, a thumb's width, I won't let anybody drink more than that. We are temperate, and I make sure people stay temperate. Somebody breaks out a book of poetry, usually, and we have 2, 3, 4 poems, maybe read, and we start discussing those poems, and then the discussion goes from there everywhere. It can go to theology, it can go to history, it can go to politics, it could go to humor, it could go to the Chicago Bears. I mean, this is a great, great group. And one of the guys who is a member of that group is a man named Mark Neal. And Mark he's published some articles on Lewis and refereed journals and so on. He's a very, very good writer. And I said, Mark, I'm doing this book on Lewis, and you need to have a book. And I said, you do this book with me. And then the next 3 books you write by yourself. And then when you write your 4th book after this, you find somebody that you think needs to be published, and you bring them into the ranks as well. And if you're willing to do that, I want you to do the book with me. So Mark and I did this book together, and Mark is a very good writer. I think he's a far better writer than I am. So anyway, that's how the book came about. Well, we were writing on each of these views of the imagination. I suppose probably for some it would have been uninteresting because it would have looked more like a laundry list of the imagination. So I get a call out of the blue from somebody from Abingdon and their academic line, and they said they wanted to do a textbook on Lewis, and would I be interested? And I said I would, but I'm already working on a book on Lewis, and they said, tell us about it. Send us what you've got done. And they said, we like the concept. Would you be willing to reduce the number of uses of the imagination you're describing from 32 down to about 12, and then maybe show how Lewis used that form of the imagination in a particular book he wrote? So I thought actually it was a good idea, and I think consequently it's actually a better book than it might have been. And we're able to show the use, and it was quite fun.
Well, if you don't mind, could you give us a few examples?
Of course, one of the ones that everybody would notice right away is when, in Surprise by Joy, he says after reading Fantasties by George MacDonald that his imagination was baptized. He said, naturally, it took me much longer. But something awakened in him after reading that book. And the baptized imagination, I would say, theologically, is the regenerative or the regenerated imagination. When all of a sudden, something of the transcendence is beginning to break in, and we're seeing things a little bit differently. The story, actually, in Fantasties that he mentions in a letter to his friend Arthur Greaves is the story of Cosmo, and it's a story within the story of Fantasties. It's probably the best story I've ever read in my life, extra-biblically. And here is this story, and we try in our book to portray the story to show how Lewis's imagination was baptized, going from Surprise by Joy, his description of the baptized imagination, and so on. Another one, in The Discarded Image, Lewis's book on the medieval worldview, he has several of these different types of imagination mentioned. One he calls the a common sense or primary imagination. And he often will attribute the use of these imaginations to particular authors. In this case, he talks about Samuel Taylor Coleridge as the proponent of primary imagination or common sense. So you and I, William, have 5 gates, empirical gates, by which we get information. Visual, sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch. But all that data comes to us willy-nilly. You are sitting in a world right now where there's light and color and sound. There are things you're smelling. There are things you're touching, even as you touch the texture of your Levi's and so on. But all that data that comes in is basically meaningless until we can sort it out and make sense of it, i.e. common sense. And take from all of this vast amount of information is coming in, and focus and come down and understand something. That itself is not an empirical activity. It is a work of the imagination. It's something actually that's immaterial going on in us all the time. And Coleridge, of course, makes note of this. Lewis understood this and used this. Another one that he talks about is the transforming imagination. Not all forms of the imagination for Lewis are positive. We are fallen people, and consequently we can corrupt things. And the transforming imagination is basically that of projection. He attributes it to Wordsworth. When Wordsworth begins to project on nature things that it's not. Wordsworth, Lewis liked Wordsworth, but Wordsworth, as he got older, he realized he was getting jaded. He didn't like the lost innocence of youth. And he begins sometimes to project on nature maybe some things that nature didn't have, this sort of idealized approach. But what we can find is there can be a type of fiction of imagination where we can make the thing we're looking at be what we want it to be rather than what it is. And I suppose the most dramatic example of that would be Lewis's The Great Divorce, where all these very fallen beings have this sense of self that's inflated, and they begin to project a reality that is not really there. Another one he talks about is the penetrating imagination. And this is the imagination that tries to go deeper and deeper in its understanding of a thing. And Lewis says directly, it's Shakespeare. And he talks about, he writes an essay called Variation in Shakespeare. It's in his selected literary essays. And he says of Shakespeare, Shakespeare can look at a thing and in one sonnet create five metaphors for the one thing. He never fully describes it, but he keeps taking the reader deeper and deeper into a nuanced understanding of this. He writes another essay in Studies in Medieval and Renaissance Literature called The Similes of Dante. And he sees Dante's able to do this too with the variety of similes that he'll bring to play in a book like The Divine Comedy and so on. The realized imagination. And Lewis says this is typically the medieval imagination. And the realized imagination is the imagination in bud that finally blooms into full flower. And Lewis says one of the great things about medieval literature is that it was often involved in embellishments. You know, he says, what did Chaucer really do to Il Filostrato? Il Filostrato's in Boccaccio's Decameron. Chaucer takes the story from Boccaccio and tells it in his Troilus and Cressida. But Boccaccio had gotten his ideas from Virgil. Virgil had gotten his ideas from Homer. And you find this development of an idea, a literary depiction, and it gets bigger and bigger with the telling of the story, even though each author nuances it to carry in the story some new theme that he or she wants to carry. And so this realized imagination, realizing imagination. And another one, he talks about the shared imagination. And the shared imagination is a rhetorician's tool. If you want to communicate rhetorically, you have to be aware of your audience. And if you're aware of your audience, you will say the things that will connect to the world where your audience is already living. Brilliant example, Mere Christianity. Lewis is on the radio, he's connecting to his audience, he's saying things that are common in human experience so that people say, oh yeah, I've had that feeling before. Oh yeah, I've thought those thoughts before. And then Lewis, almost like herding sheep, corrals those shared or common experiences into a focused understanding of some deep theological truth. So those would just be some examples.
That's very good. Well, this is something that we definitely look forward to and appreciate a chance. I'm recording here with Jerry as we're at the Grove City Conference for the C.S. Lewis and Inkling Society. Since he is one of the featured speakers, I made an effort to catch up with him to share about this forthcoming book, and hopefully maybe we'll have an opportunity to have you back to share some more details about this book as well as some of your other titles. In closing, though, maybe what do you see in terms of, since this says it's an introduction, there are other titles that will come forth, hopefully, or it just remains to be seen what happens with this one?
Well, my concern, and Abingdon's concern also, is that this book would be useful for courses taught at universities. Schools all over the world are starting to produce Lewis and Tolkien courses. And that's because people are interested in this writing. You remember when The Lord of the Rings came out and The Hobbit and so on? You just had a small section of fantasy works. Now you've got rows of fantasy books that are being written. And the interest is huge, and so people are going to the well, the primary source, you know, these particular authors, these great mythopoeic authors. And I think that we're hoping, by way of introduction, this will introduce people in these courses, secular and Christian universities both. But also, if you say sequel, I'm hoping the sequel will be the hunger and thirst of young academics, young students, and they'll get into this and they'll begin reading and they'll want to write books as well. But let me say a word to your audience about writing books on Lewis and Tolkien. The introductory books generally have a short shelf life. There's always a need for more, therefore. So many of them say the same thing because they're expressing the things that new readers to these authors have discovered and loved. And so they talk about the things they love. The difficulty is there's a difference in class of the kinds of introductory books that are coming out. There's the arrogant writer who tells us what Lewis said or thought. And I can tell you when I read those books, my mind is like a pickle soaking in the brine of C.S. Lewis. I've read all of the titles over and over and over again. And I can tell you what the author has not read when they said Lewis believed this, because they didn't clarify when he believed that, or were there other books that might have nuanced this and brought a wider bandwidth to understanding of this concept so that Lewis did not believe it in the narrow way that it was described in the book. But the ones who are really moved by Lewis, who are writing these introductory texts or introductory books, who I think have great merit and great promise, and I hope they end up becoming the great leading Lewis scholars of the next generation, are the ones who can write about him and say, you know, it would appear that Lewis believed this. Or from this particular text, we can assume that Lewis had these ideas. It's nuanced honestly. The author is not inflating what they seem to know or making their audience think they know more than they do. There's an honesty to their writing, and I think it's commendable. So I want to encourage more and more people to get into Lewis, write more and more books. We haven't even begun to explore all the things that ought to be explored in Lewis. We want to see the things he said in The Personal Heresy. He said, you don't pay attention to the author when you read a book. You want to use the author as a pair of spectacles and see the world he saw. Don't make a spectacle of the author. And Lewis was so wide-ranging in his curiosities, in his interests, in the questions he asked. C.S. Lewis opens more than wardrobe doors. And we have a need for people to help us open the door wider. Let in the light of our own curiosities and let us discover some of the things that Lewis discovered. And there's so much research that has yet to be done. I hope people will read that book and say, wow, I want to go do more and take it further. And I would be pleased if that happens.
This definitely sounds like a fascinating title. I encourage people to check it out when it comes out, or if you're listening to this when it's already been released, to definitely get a copy. Jerry, thank you for joining me for the show.
Thank you, William. You're really a kind guy, and I'm grateful for all your work you're doing and the way you're encouraging people to do honest scholarship.
Again, I'm William O'Flaherty, the creator and producer of All About Jack. Thank you for listening to my show. This podcast is one of the many features at EssentialCSLewis.com. Stop by EssentialCSLewis.com for any links mentioned in the show and for previous episodes of All About Jack. I spoke with Dr. Diana Glier, who was also a guest speaker at the conference, and plan to release that in the next few weeks. But I also reposted my chat with her from a few years ago about her book, The Company They Keep. There'll also be a link in the show notes for that. Recent new interviews include an essay chat on Screwtape Proposes a Toast, And also, the latest issue from Christian History, a magazine, is about seven literary sages. I have an interview regarding that. Other older shows include chats with Dr. Alistair McGrath, Dr. Devin Brown, and Colin Duryea on each of their biographies on C.S. Lewis from 2013. Listen to these programs and others when you visit again EssentialCSLewis.com, but you can also go to where the audio files are hosted. That address is allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. If you have any questions or comments, you can email them to info@EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, that's info@EssentialCSLewis.com.